Quick, remember your dreams.
Okay, so I've had really weird dreams since I got sick.
Still ongoing?
But last night, this morning, at 5 o'clock in the morning, I woke up and I was like, that was a weird dream. And I got up and peed and I was like, I still remember it. And then I was like, okay. And then I went back into the dream when I got up from peeing.
Wait, you continue dreams? Usually... Yeah,
do you not continue dreams?
Oh, usually I start a new one. Well, these days, frequently, if I wake up at 3 or 4 to go pee, there are even odds that I'm not going back to sleep.
There's a real, it's very important that I not open my eyes fully, is what I've learned.
Yes.
If I don't open my eyes fully, I'm just kind of like,
Don't perceive.
Yeah.
Don't think. Don't. Yeah.
Like the act of having to aim at the toilet sometimes is enough cognitive load that it wakes me up. So yes. Anyway.
Don't cogitate on the way through the bathroom or back.
No. So, hold on. There's like three different ways this could go. Have you seen the threads about how everybody experiences, how everybody's brain works differently? You know, how everybody's neurodiverse and like when some people are able to make pictures of things and hold a really solid picture of a 3D object in their head, like with close detail and the whole thing.
Sure.
And some people can only have like a 2D flat, like a caricature essentially. And some people just have like the basic shape and that's it, like color shape, maybe not even the color. And some people just are incapable of doing it. I learned today that also applies to inner monologues.
Oh, yeah. Are you talking about the thing that was going around a few months ago, maybe a year ago now?
It goes around. It's always going around. It's eternally cycling, depending on your friend groups.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. I remember there was a minor hubbub on my Twitter feed, at least maybe within the last year, of people going like, oh, my God, I just learned that some people don't have inner monologues.
I don't have inner monologues.
Wait, you don't?
I have no. OK, so this has happened to me multiple times in my life. Like when you read, do you like say the words in your head when you're reading?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I've never done that. I just read the word and the ideas in the brain.
Like I can read and not like slowly, or you know, I can not take the time to pronounce the words out loud, and I can still derive the meaning. But just like naturally, unless I force myself, like I hear the words as I read them.
Yeah, see, I never ever hear the word. Like when I started working in the magazine, and I had to. One of the editor tips was like, you have to read the word out loud because like if you read it out loud and it sounds right when you're saying it in a sentence. Like I literally have to move my lips to make that work because I can't do it in my head.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, no interior monologue. But the dream last night, I dreamed that I was for some reason applying for a job at Activision, I think working on Call of Duty.
Sounds more like a nightmare to me. Am I right?
It's not anything I would consciously do.
Mm-hmm.
I dreamt that when I got there, I went in and there was nobody to like greet you or tell you what to do. You just got put down in a like you walked into like a vestibule with some couches and like ferns. And then somebody came in and called your name like you were at a doctor's office with a clipboard.
It's all true to life so far.
Yeah, exactly. When I went through this door with this person, they assigned me a portable air conditioner, like a one on wheels with the hoses out the back.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to carry that through this entire like all day 8-person interview process.
Were you in fact interviewing in hell?
I it was very Severance. Okay. The whole thing was a little bit weird. And I got to the end of the interview process and like nobody took the air conditioner away, but they had made me leave my phone in the car because I couldn't have like an electronic device in that in you know, where the Call of Duties are made.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, well, I can't. They told me not to leave the air conditioner unsupervised because somebody would steal it. So I was really paranoid about it. Like I took it in the bathroom with me, the whole thing all day long. So I was like, if I take this out to the parking lot to my car, they're going to think I'm trying to steal this portable air conditioner to get my phone to call the, you know, call the information number. But if I don't, then somebody will steal it and then I'll have lost the air conditioner. Both of these things are bad. What do I do? So I carried the air conditioner out to the car. And then, of course, the moment I step out and it hits the parking lot wheels on the parking lot, somebody comes out and is like, hey, what the hell are you doing with that air conditioner? And that's when I woke up.
Boo.
Yeah. I want to know what the air conditioner means, man. What does it mean?
I was very excited for you to get a free air conditioner out of the stream, a dream air conditioner.
Oh, man, I'd love a dream air conditioner. That sounds so good. Welcome to to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad.
Brad, what are we doing this week?
What are we doing this week? Well, let's see. Let me flip through the previous six or so discarded ideas before we got to this one.
I think that the air conditioner represents my fear that we didn't have a podcast topic when I went to bed last night.
You're starting to sweat.
And the air conditioner was the was my anxiety about the podcast topic this week.
Getting a little hot under the collar as the deadline approaches.
Maybe, yeah.
Talk about this on the Discord a little bit.
Yeah.
Was it 2 weekends ago or was it 3 weekends ago? Whatever weekend Outside Lands was here.
Mm.
I ended up editing that week's show at about 11:30 that night.
Yeah, that was 2 weeks ago.
I basically started editing that podcast about an hour before it needed to post.
Yeah, that's a little late.
And look, I think if our episode went up at say 12:30 instead of midnight, what are they going to do?
I'm surprised you're up that late. That's late for you.
Usually not. I was listening to the Green Day show.
Oh, that's right.
Anyway, I got it in under the gun. Exported the WAV file at about 11:57.
Thank God you have fast internet.
And then it was a race against time to encode and tag and upload.
I was, I'm not going to lie. I'm the right kind of procrastinator that I kind of enjoy that.
It was a bit exhilarating. Oh, let's see. Here is the thing that I derived the most satisfaction from.
Okay.
I still scheduled it. I didn't just click publish.
Okay. So you made it in time.
The time on my Windows clock said 11:59 PM. So I scheduled it for midnight with about 30 seconds to spare, and then it auto posted just like always.
I only have one question for you, Brad.
Mm-hmm.
Did they play Basket Case?
Of course. Absolutely.
Okay.
1,000, but I think that might be their most popular song.
Only for people our age. Cause they have a whole 21st century pop punk renaissance fan base that is American Idiot era.
Dude, is there a single Green Day fan on the planet that does not revere Dookie?
So when I saw them, when they were on the American Idiot tour at Pac Bell, what was then Pac Bell Park, they did not play Dookie
at all.
They didn't, they played,
I could see it. That was their big comeback. Cause they had a period of commercial insignificance.
Yeah. I don't think they played, they might've played Welcome to Paradise, but yeah, I was disappointed. All I wanted was Dookie. I wanted nothing. I would have gone to at that point in my life, I would have gone to a show that was just a start to finish track 1 through 14 mm-hmm. Dookie playback concert. Anyway.
All right. I think I have officially burned my quota of talking about Green Day on podcasts now. Oh,
did you do it this week on Nextlander too?
It's been two or three times now. You know what? I shouldn't say we discarded all the ideas we went through this morning. I think two or three of them are going to become episodes.
Yeah, I think there's an episode on the history of electronic music that I would love to do. I think that's mm-hmm. really cool.
Yeah.
And
I can't believe we've never done this. We got a request for a Bluetooth episode, just kind of everything about Bluetooth start to finish.
Yeah. And then a friend of the pod, David Ellis, asked for an episode about home video recording technology, which was super interesting. And then the iPhone 4 came out and it all just went away. It's all just phones now. So remember the flip camera? That was a cool thing.
I think we bought three.
We had five of them at Whiskey.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were not great.
You know what? They were better than the alternative.
It's fair.
Yeah. This week, people have asked for this. This is another listener request episode. People asked for the history of Foo VR, which was the company I started in 2015 when I left Tested. I kind of got the VR bug.
This is a great idea. I had no idea that you wheeled this out just oh, we could do the history of Foo VR. I was like, wait, what? Where did that come from? I had no idea people had requested that. But if I had, I would have said, yeah, let's do it because it sounds fascinating.
We've gotten a bunch of requests over the years because it kind of came out of nowhere for viewers. I think realistically, it all started when I saw the Vive at GDC in 2015.
Right. And I remember talking to you about that at the time it happened. I will say before we get into this real quick, I think this topic is even just interesting from a general perspective, setting aside the VR component, also just hearing about the process of founding and trying to run a little boutique tech startup, I think. Is also a fascinating thing.
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of ways we had the normal tech startup loop of, wow, this thing, we could change the world with this, right? We could be the next Desilu, which is a thing I literally said in a pitch meeting one time. Okay.
So phase one, idealism.
Yeah. All the way down to the grim reality of a multi-year worldwide pandemic that destroyed a lot of in-person events. Anyway.
Yeah.
Spoilers, I guess.
But I remember talking to you and maybe talked to Norm as well. But I remember you guys coming back from that GDC meeting and just like gushing in a way that it was like hard for me to actually envision what you had seen there, because you were using like borderline magical language about the experience of being in that headset.
Well, so, okay. So up until that point, we'd done a lot of Oculus stuff, and the Oculus stuff at that time, there were no hands. So you were using like a gamepad and a headset, or keyboard and mouse and a handset, or a joystick and a hand, you know, like established PC gaming controls. Right. And the difference with the Vive was that they belted this thing on you in a small room, and there was somebody in the room with you to kind of supervise and make sure if something crashed or whatever, it wasn't going to go bad. And then they gave you these controllers to hold in your hands that you could move representations of your hands around in the world. And like, there's a video on Tested. You can watch it. Norm and I did these demos. We weren't allowed to record any of them. So we literally had a video of us like walking down the booth of cool Valve hardware in their GDC booth. And then we stood outside in front of a sign and talked for like 45 minutes about what the experience was. Fantastic video. Could have been changing the world with that stuff. But it's interesting because it literally is our react. Like, we literally walked out of that room and stepped straight outside and started talking.
Oh yeah. You guys were like buzzing about that thing hard.
Well, so like up until that point, I don't want to say skeptical, cause I wasn't really skeptical, but I was kind of lukewarm. Cause up until that point, VR stuff felt like a novel screen for existing types of like cockpit games and, right, and stuff like that.
And did Oculus have a product on the market besides the DK2 at that point?
No. So both of the headsets came out in the spring of 2016 within like a week of each other.
Oh, wow.
That's maybe right. Two weeks of each other.
I think, yeah, we did streams too, I believe. I remember.
Yeah, you did.
I remember that whole VR window.
Yeah. So this was in March of 2015 or April of 2015 around GDC. And it was basically a year out from the Oculus. And then we saw the Vive for the first time. And we had heard about, you'd hear people talking about Valve's VR room where they had QR codes and stuff, but I hadn't seen anything, and it was unclear that if it was ever going to become a product, right? Because they had a handful of developers working on it and not a lot. So I saw this, and we talked about it on the video, and we got to the point that was important, I think, in the video, which is that like having hands gives you access to a lot more verbs. But I couldn't stop thinking about it, and I wasn't exactly sure why. It took me a while to figure it out.
Yeah, it's not just the verbs, the actions you can do. Also, it's got to happen at the subconscious level somewhere in the lizard brain component of just like moving your hand and seeing a one-to-one action with the movement of your hand is like,
well,
you know, like that activates certain very like primal sorts of feelings about movement and interaction.
It means that a lot of stuff that you have to think about in video games when you're translating, like throwing to pulling a trigger, just happen because your brain already knows how to do them. Right. At the same time, there's a real separation because you're in environments that your brain completely doesn't understand. I can't remember the name of the company, but the Blue is the first. It was one of the things that blew me away there. Haha. And that was the thing where you walk on the deck of the ship that's sunk under the sea and you see the whale swimming by and all that stuff. And like it's that stuff that your brain can understand. Right. But it was interesting. And so I thought about this like nonstop for like 6 months. It was literally, I was completely obsessed with it. And it took me a while to understand what I realized was important, which is, hey, all the stuff that they showed us, there wasn't really a lot of storytelling. It was all like arcade-y type game stuff, like shooting bows and arrows at guys at balloons and stuff like that, or blowing up balloons, or drawing in Tilt Brush, or I think there was a Google Earth demo in there. I can't remember now. But nobody, there wasn't any storytelling stuff. And the reason there wasn't a lot of storytelling stuff was none of the language that we have developed around telling stories on 2D screens, like TVs and movie screens and stuff like that, or video games even, was going to work in VR because you had to look like with traditional storytelling, you could control what the viewer sees by aiming the camera in a different place. And that's not possible in VR because the viewer controls where the camera is looking at all times.
Like you physically, for reasons of nausea, you can't force them into stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I knew people who were working on 360 video storytelling stuff, and I tried it and I was like, it's not great. I knew that making like game-like 3D content that was interactive was going to be as expensive as making games. And I knew that the people that were making content for VR, we're thinking in terms of film, which is a more predictable, straightforward cost structure. And I was like, is there a way to take the stuff, the interactivity of games, and build it on a cost structure that content creators can work with? And so I started looking at IK and stuff like that. And I was like, at that point in my career, I'd started in 98 and I'd seen PCs take off and I'd seen the internet kind of become a mainstream thing. And I watched phones happen. And I was like, I don't want to watch another one of these things from the sidelines and write about it. I want to do it.
Can I stop you real quick? Should we define IK? I assume you mean inverse kinematics.
Inverse kinematics. So inverse kinematics is something, the first place I learned about inverse kinematics was probably with the tripods in Half-Life 2. But it basically it's a mathematical formula that lets you determine how to get joints. If you have the two endpoints of a chain of joints, you can figure out legal positions for them along the way.
Yeah. I think like the practical example is foot planting for characters in games. Remember when characters would run up steps and their feet just like, you know, their feet followed like a very scripted, prescribed running animation and kind of disregard, like they were running up a flat slope, incline, realistically, not actually steps. Like,
yeah,
IK is the thing that made its way into games. And like, I had friends in visual effects that had made me understand what it was back around like 2000 when Star Wars prequels were coming out and stuff like that. But like seeing it get into games was a mind blowing revelation. Cause like, oh wow, this character's feet actually respect where the steps are now. And like more or less realistically look like they're planting their feet in the right places.
Yeah. The thing we used it for early on, is that you could place elbows. Like if you knew where the hands were and you could make a guess where the shoulders were, you could place the elbows in a reasonable place and the wrist in a reasonable position.
Right.
It's more complicated than that, obviously. It's always more complicated than that.
So, sorry for the digression. Yeah. So you're like watching VR happen and going like, oh, I can't miss this boat.
Well, and the thing I realized is that the work we had done at Whiskey and I had done it tested where we were like figuring out where I think the defining characteristic of Whiskey Media was that we were pretty good at figuring out what were the corners we could cut in terms of production to make something that was still compelling and interesting, but without spending $1 bazillion on every single piece of content.
Yes. Yes. no career will prepare you for churning out content as fast and cheap as possible as working in online media.
Yeah. I told Tested I was leaving. I flew down to LA. I emailed my boss one morning. I was like, hey, can I come down and talk to you about something? I have some questions. She's like, yeah, hop on the plane. I'll see you tomorrow. So I was like, okay, sure. This is great. So I flew down. We had this great conversation about what she was excited about. And I was like, oh, by the way, I'm going to quit.
What she was excited about with Tested specifically.
With Tested. It was like, and of course the whole time I'm on the plane going down and I'm like, is this a horrible mistake? Am I fucking this up really badly? And then I got in the meeting and she like gave me the out, right? She gave me the, I could chicken out right now. I talked to Gina about it and I talked to friends and a bunch of other people. I was like, and she's like, oh, wow. Well, that was awkward, huh? So anyway,
like she was cool about it.
Yeah, she's great. She's I absolutely love her to death. She's one of my favorite people.
So one of the things I wanted to unpack when we started this episode was the psychology of, God, there's like a bunch of things here. I mean, A, leaving a steady paycheck, you know, steady employment to go start a company that may or may not succeed. Like that in and of itself, I guess, depending on your personality, is either terrifying or exhilarating or both, probably both for most people.
Both, I would say, yeah.
But you know, like some people can be so risk averse that like that idea just is like anathema to their personalities, right? Like the mere possibility of failure is enough for a lot of people to say, like, you know what? I like having health insurance. I like having a steady paycheck. I'm gonna stick with a job and not go try to start something. And then there's the layer on top of that here of this is an unproven technology. It seems amazing, like it's very capable and it works, but like, for example, I don't know, this is a lot of questions, but like, you must have thought about this as you were on your way out the door. Like, what if headsets don't sell at a scale that allows me to actually monetize the stuff we want to make for them?
I mean, so the plan was to make B2B tools, not to make B2C tools. So
that's interesting. That's an interesting thing to discuss because I had never quite understood what the ultimate goal was, because you did launch with like and I'm getting ahead of ourselves, like Kickstarter, with more front-facing, like kind of consumer level content, but
well,
I'll let you get into it.
So The pitch was, hey, people are going to need tools to make content cheap. And part of it is that we need something that lets us experiment because we don't really understand how storytelling is going to work in this medium. So I told Tester I was leaving before I'd reached out to any employees or anything, because that's what my attorney friends had advised me to do. And in the Reddit thread, so to get into your question about the psychology, let's see, Obamacare had passed a few years before.
Okay.
So I was reasonably sure that I'd be able to get decent health insurance, without pre-existing conditions. I think if I had had socialized medicine, it would have been a lot less scary.
Dude, don't get me on a soapbox here. You cannot overstate how discouraging to like even small scale, like entrepreneurship, the lack of
terrifying
healthcare in this country is. Like,
yeah,
as somebody who is dealing with some unbelievable COBRA bullshit right now.
Yeah.
On a COBRA plan that's only got like 3 more months in it before I'm on my own for health insurance. It sucks. It sucks.
So yeah, it's like it is. So I was confident that we could get healthcare. I knew that I would be able to do some freelancing for other folks, and help cover some of my expenses, which I was not as concerned about. I don't know. I guess at the time I quit, I was looking at the dates before this. I don't think that the pricing for any of the headsets had been announced yet. So it was unclear, you know, so I was taking a gamble that yes, we were going to have this. Like there were a lot of questions, like whether they'd be able to sell headsets, whether there'd be an audience for it, that people would actually like it. I was pretty convinced after seeing the Vive. Like I don't really know many people who spent a lot of time in Vive stuff that weren't pretty blown away by it. I don't know that everybody was convinced enough to dedicate a room of their house to it. But I think with what ended up being the Quest from Facebook, I think you have a pretty close approximation of something that's good. Now it has a lot of baggage because of the Facebook connection, which is unfortunate. But anyway, so it was scary. Like it wasn't not scary. I just turned 40.
Okay.
I was like a year or two. I turned 40 that year, actually, I guess.
That's like a good point in your life to go like, I want to do something else. I've still got time.
Yeah. I was like, if I'm going to do this, this is the last chance probably.
You don't see a lot of like 50 plus year old startup founders out there, do you?
You do more now.
Oh, do you?
It turns out. Yeah, because the people who started doing this 30 years ago are still at it, like still a lot of them. Yeah. But then it was a little bit more unusual, I thought. Anyway, it was scary leaving without a tech founder, without somebody to help who could actually do the work, the programming and figure out how to glue all the ideas together.
Do you mean from like an investment standpoint? Like if you
needed- No, it meant from a me ideas are worth nothing, Brad.
Oh yeah. I mean, there are, of course there's the practical, but I mean, you can hire for technical skills.
Yes. So, I mean, we can talk about mistakes I made later on, but this is one of the mistakes, not actually taking the time and finding somebody who was an established, and had like Silicon Valley chops to serve as a tech co-founder and splitting with them in the beginning was a mistake. Like that would have made a lot of stuff a lot easier. So anyway, there was a big Reddit thread when I announced I was leaving. And at the bottom of that thread, there was a post from a guy who said, hey, I think that there's some really interesting social stuff you can do if you do hand-tracked VR plus IK. If that sounds interesting, do you send me a message? And I sent him a message and he posted a video. And I looked at the video. I was like, this is exactly what I want. This is what I'm thinking about.
Video of his work?
Video of a demo he had put together using like the default Unreal mannequin, or sorry, the default Unity mannequin and some IK code that he'd written up using basic IK libraries and then some work he'd done to, because the thing, okay, so here's the other thing everybody thinks they understand and they don't. Everybody says, oh, you can just use IK to do that. What that means is you can use IK to make horrible nightmares. Like IK.
No.
The thing that you saw was bad, but not anywhere near that bad. Like IK will make, it basically just is path of least resistance and you can put resistance on the spring on each of the joints. And if you're good at tuning, you can make something that looks kind of okay, but not great. The trick is you have to have some other system that's pushing back against the IK to push it into more human constraints. And that was where we did a lot of our work over the years.
So what are some examples of the counter systems that?
Oh, there's all sorts like machine learning and like SIBs and stuff like that. There's a bazillion different approaches and all of them have problems and you can combine them in interesting ways and build structures that like switch back and forth between them based on condition of the model and stuff like that.
You're talking like programmatic systems. I was envisioning like simulation of physical systems. Like I thought you meant like maybe gravity or musculature or something like.
Well, so one of the things we did was, you use gravity, you use musculature, you mimic those with springs and like, I can't remember the other, hydraulic piston analogs, right? Resistance that goes the other way than springs, pushing resistance. None of it works perfect in all situations. You end up either having to do the best you can for the most situations or you switch back and forth. And we tried a bunch of different things over the years to make it look better, look more believable. And the goal, of course, with all of this was to let people do motion capture with a cheap VR headset. Well, you know, what is a cheap by motion capture senses VR headset without, so that they could experiment with interactive 3D rendered VR stuff. For the cost of making some models and rigs and stuff like that.
Right. So was that the business plan from day one? Let's ultimately distill this down to something where all you need is the off the shelf VR hardware and you can do at least like basic animation.
And art. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was the plan. And actually we hewed to that pretty closely through the time that Foo was active. So I met Andre on Reddit from his video post and talked to him on the phone and he sent me some videos and then he sent me some code and I could try it out I'd sent Chet at Valve who was leading their VR efforts and we knew him through a bunch of stuff, but a note and was like, hey, I'm going to quit tested and do VR stuff. Can you send me hardware? He's like, sure. What's the address? And sent me like dev kits immediately, which was super sweet. Let's see, we met our tech artist, Sindra Scar, from Campo Santo. Friends at Campo had recommended him. He had done the rig for Henry and they were like, he's really awesome. He was tech artists are rare and wonderful people who do things it's one of those things that people in games say as a category, but it means like 15 different things. Cause it's like, sometimes a tech artist is the person who does all of the rigs for all the models, which are what let you turn a 3D model into something that moves, right?
Something you can animate. Like the rigging is kind of what binds to your animation stuff.
Yeah, it binds the bones to the mesh so that the mesh moves in believable ways. And it's a really dark, it's hard to do. It's a high skill job. A lot of them write shaders. A lot of them write like tools that let you add variety into the game without having to create a bazillion art assets. So you like combine like five different textures into variations of a enemy or something like that.
Anyway. So again, the label here is technical artist. That's the common
technical artist is the term. Label for that. Yeah.
Cause a lot of what you're describing sounds way more like programming than art.
Well, so it is, but it'll be programming in scripting type programming. I mean, also it's also programming and it's also shader programming.
Yeah, shader language.
It's all sorts of stuff. Yeah. But it's funny. Cause like in our studio, they're not the people like I don't know. They work and they both write code and they make art. It's a weird, so Sindra ended up making all of our environments. All of our original art was made by him, including the models, the character models for the Foo Show and the other stuff we did, as well as a lot of the 3D assets. We often would bring contractors in to help him, but he did the main brunt of that work. So we had a core group of three people. We built a demo of like the record of the output, the recorded output that played as a game that people could interact with and walk around. And started showing it to people, first friends, and then VCs and angel investors. And that process was awful, it turns out.
Can I ask, I don't know how much you want to get into this stuff. Like, was everyone just kind of working on spec at this point?
Yeah, I think at this point, we hadn't even incorporated the company yet at this point.
Okay.
Because there was no reason to, like, we didn't want to do that until we were sure we weren't going to have to shut it down because there's cost involved with shutting it down. So we were mostly like, I was still working at Tested at this point, but had told them I was quitting, and was doing this in evenings and weekends. And the, other guys were working their normal jobs or doing Sindra usually works as a contractor often. So he was doing this in his spare time. And then the VC demos, like, we had interest and in we had got late stages with people. And then we invariably got to the point where, like, the VC that we had spoken to and that was advocating for us inside their agent, inside their fund, had to take it to his deciding board. And that we almost always didn't make it past that point because, like, A, we were a little bit late for VR investment at this point. Like, the hot period for that was like 2 years before to a year before. But B, what we were talking about looked like really shitty animation for people who were like used to seeing 360 video of like the top of Mount Everest and stuff like that. And like, if they didn't understand either storytelling or so fundamental the couple of fundamental problems. One is that we looked bad, which is fair. You know, it's like the animation wasn't, especially back then, was not great. Two, we looked like a content company to the Silicon Valley people that wanted tech companies. And we looked like a tech company to the LA funds that wanted content companies. So we were kind of neither fish nor fowl, I think, in retrospect. And then the other thing I messed up there on is that instead of pitching the actual product, which was the tool that lets people create the content inexpensively and like letting somebody record something and then play it back in the demo, which I think we maybe did, but we didn't make it clear what was happening. We showed them the product of the product, right? So we showed them what the VR content looked like, not what the tool that lets people create the VR content looked like.
Right.
Which, well.
Would there have been downsides of taking investment if that had gone through? I mean, like, do you think that, or maybe another way to put it is like, would that have dramatically changed the way things went if you had gotten that funding?
We could have hired our way out of a lot of problems and we wouldn't have had to do things like raise money from, we wouldn't have had to take as many contract jobs we would have taken contract jobs to use as dog food for the content rather than to pay the bills, which is what we ended up doing.
Right.
So we ended up like if we had had a few $100,000 in the bank at this point, it would have changed that. I also would have personally incurred a lot less debt. So that would have been nice.
Actually, let me hone or rephrase that question. Would that have given investors oversight over what you were doing in a way that would have interfered with your goals and processes? Like, I don't know. I mean, and maybe every deal is different, but I don't know, like, once you take investment like that, like, how much the money people are then able to stand over your shoulder and like constantly question what you're doing.
I mean, I think we would have had a little bit more oversight, which probably wouldn't have been a bad thing. I think having like as a first time CEO, I could have used help for sure. You know, it's you take venture money and it comes with good and bad, right? Like the bad is that if you do a bad job, they can take over your company for you, which is actually I guess that depends on whether you think you're doing a bad job too. but yeah, I don't know. It doesn't, I don't know how that would have gone. I don't know what would have been, we would have been able to hire out of some problems. We could have actually gotten help with stuff that we desperately needed help with. Like having somebody to help with the finance stuff would have reduced my stress levels infinitely. having somebody who could help us with like the, like set up a little bit more structure on the engineering side, since Andre was relatively green at this point too, would have helped us a ton. You know, I think we would have incurred less tech debt on so after that demo, we basically put together the first episode of the Foo Show because we wanted a piece of dog food content. As dog food meaning we wanted something to prototype our tools against. So we needed a piece of like if it's the same problem we had when we talked to the Blender guys, they described, right, where they needed people making animated films with Blender in order to be able to test to build tools against the types of content that people are going to produce with the tool. And we were in a similar situation. So we started working on the Firewatch episode because you know, I'd known the guys at Campo for years and was like, hey, here's this thing. They were one of the groups of people I talked to when we were starting. I was like, hey, you just recently started your own thing. How do you feel about this? Would you do it again now? This was, I guess, before Firewatch had come out at this point. And they were like, hey, well, anything we can do to help, let me know. So then about 6 months later, I was like, hey, I'd love to make here's what I would like to make. A version of Tested that works on things that are ephemeral that you can't show in real life. You can't point a camera at. And they're like, that sounds awesome. We're in. And they, and literally Jake Rodkin handed me, he was like, do you have a portable hard drive or something? I was like, yeah, sure. And he copied their Unity project over onto it. This was after the game was out, in fairness.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I got into that thing and how cool, because I had played through Firewatch not that long before.
Yeah.
Like the idea of walking around in the same assets of the game you had just played a few months earlier was like kind of magical and transportive.
The reaction, and we left this in the show. We had a real long conversation about whether we should leave it or not. But when they first put their headsets on, when we were doing the recording with them and they were in the watchtower, like it was such a moment. It's such a triumphant moment. Because it's like, they get to physically experience this thing that they had worked on for a really long time. It was cool. That episode launched, I think, the Friday after the Rift came out and the day of the Vive launch. And like 250,000 people ended up watching it overall, I think, wow, is my understanding, in the first year. The last time I looked at stats.
And that's, let's see, how was it distributed? Was it just on Steam?
It was on Steam and Oculus Store, both.
And Oculus, okay.
Yeah, so if you had a CV1, you could, Oculus Rift CV1, you could play, if you had a Vive, you could play, or any of the other Steam VR headsets, still on Steam.
I'm sure that targeting the launch of the hardware was not an accident.
I mean, we were going to run out of money pretty soon, so we were just trying to do the best we could.
Okay, so was there any kind of crunch leading up to headsets launching and trying to get it out?
When it's a three-person, so we'd raised a little bit of money from friends and family, which gave us like 6 months of runway if I basically just took enough money to pay for the mortgage, right? And then paid for the rest of my stuff out of savings, which is what we did. And like that got us basically to the launch of the headsets a little bit after. And then that being very popular got us a lot of interest from media companies and advertising agencies and stuff like that. And we ended up spending a lot of like 2016 and 2017 and actually 2018 too, working on contract projects and Foo Show episodes. Right. So we did some ads for GameStop. We did a show for Adult Swim called with Carl from Aqua Teen Hunger Force every Wednesday, talking about NFL through the entire NFL season in, I think, 2017, 2018. We did a bunch of pilots that I can't talk about. We built some other multiplayer experiences that were live using our animation pipeline that were like prototypes and proofs of concepts for other people. Some of them were really cool. We built a really freaking cool escape room that I can never show anybody, unfortunately.
Does that work still exist?
I mean, it's on a backup somewhere here, but sure. Yeah.
We'll never see the light of day.
Can't show it.
Yeah. Let's see. I'm sorry if I'm losing track of the timeline. Stuff?
I did skip a bunch there. Yeah. We didn't talk about Kickstarter. So, okay. So,
The Kickstarter was before this later contract stuff, right?
The contract stuff was happening kind of throughout this entire time.
Okay.
The contract stuff was how we paid our bills after the initial 50, 75 grand of seed money from friends and family wore out. We took another 50 grand from somebody else, but we didn't take a lot of investment. Our friends, the Andes, who run XOXO in Portland, asked us to come and do a Foo Show episode on as part of their animation track of their festival, the nighttime events at XOXO. XOXO is a festival for indie creators. They used to do it every year, and the pandemic happened.
Yeah. This is also 2016, same year as the headsets.
This is 2016, same year as the headsets. So we talked to Brendan Chang at Quad Cow at Blendo Games, and we're like, hey, we'd like to do Quad Cow on stage at XOXO. And he said, yes. And we were thrilled. And then we ported. So let's see. Firewatch is a Unity game. Quad Cow is a Quake 3 engine game, I believe.
Wait, is it Quake 3 or Doom? I know. Let me see. I believe
pretty sure it's Quake 3.
A lot of his stuff, I think he built on Quake 3, but I want to say he switched to the Doom 3 engine at some point.
He might have switched to Doom 3. But anyway,
I love to death the fact that he makes all of his games on these old open source id engines.
Well, and the cool thing about QuadCow is the assets were really straightforward. So it was really, really like we like this. This all came together in maybe a month, maybe 6 weeks.
Wow.
So yeah, there was crunch. I mean, I don't know if it wasn't like forced crunch, but like we all wanted to do it and we had to get there somehow. So,
Okay, yes. So that one was, sorry, just to correct the record. That one was Doom 3. I think all his previous stuff was Quake 3.
Okay. Before
that.
It Tech 4, I guess. Right.
Yeah. Whatever they're calling it now.
Anyway, so we put that together really fast and Brendan sent us a bunch of assets over and we jammed it together and Syndra did his magic. Like a large part of what Syndra did in addition to making the models was porting shaders that were designed for 2D, you know, flat screens into 3D stereo correct shaders. And it turns out not as much of a problem with QuadCow because not a lot of shader work there. We did that live on stage. So we set up a Vive with two people in it on stage. And for people who don't know, we posted a bunch of videos about it this at the time, but for people who don't know, what we did was we set up the Vive lighthouses. This was back in the old days when you can only have two of them in a space. And we set them up on as high a poles as we could get, usually some really tall light stands. And we tilted them down so they'd mostly hit from above. And we would use the full 5 meter by 5 meter area. Because when you're in a multiplayer VR experience, you can't really teleport unless you teleport everybody the exact same amount or else you get out of sync with each other, because we needed the people in the space to not, we needed your physical position in the real world to align with your virtual location in the virtual world for both of you. And if you slipped, then you'd walk into each other almost invariably. And there were also cable problems to deal with. That's a whole other thing.
Sure.
And if we lost line of sight to either of the hands or the headset, then that person would fly off into space, usually back to the origin, right, which also is undesirable.
I mean,
it's pretty funny.
There's something entertaining about it. I cannot imagine how nerve wracking it must have been to rely on this, like, I'm not going to say unproven technology, but it was still certainly very new and a bit unknown, and to have to do that all live on stage and hope that it all works.
I didn't actually say why pitching to VCs was horrible. And it's because VC offices, the VR hardware back then, especially pre-Vive, if there was anything reflective in the room, it just would not work.
Yeah, and I bet there were a lot of like glass tabletops and...
Oh my God, it's so much glass and chrome in VC offices.
Oh God, I bet.
So I had also there were no laptops that would drive VR back then. So I had to carry two desktop computers, two monitors, a VR headset, maybe two VR headsets, the light poles, all of the stuff, power strips enough to make everything work, networking stuff to make them talk to each other, even without internet access. And then on top of all of that, I had to have another bag that was full of black drapes to put over anything metal or chrome in the offices that I went to. So yeah, it was great. I stopped counting when I hit 500 people. I demoed 500, did 500 VR demos. And a lot of it was like family and friends to practice. Dude, and stuff like
on,
that.
Hang on.
Yeah.
It is hard for me to wrap my head around that number.
I mean, I was doing 3 or 4 a day.
That's three or four
sessions with usually multiple people would come because people were really curious about VR. That's the other thing you don't remember. It's like pre the headsets coming out, because this was all in like 2015. And pre the headsets coming out, everybody wanted to see it because nobody had seen it yet. So people would be like, come and bring their, like, I had VCs come and bring their kids. It's a little weird, but it's fine.
Depending on the VC, I bet if you convince their kids, you might convince them too.
Well, that was part of it. Yeah. We did a whole bunch of demos. And the 500 was over the course of the first year and a half. It wasn't all in that 3 month period, obviously. Yeah, so many demos. I was so sweaty at all every single one of those because I'd schlepped up 200 pounds of gear. And then, yeah, the worst one was the person who got, I got there and they're like, hey, we're really sorry, our elevator's not working. We're on the third floor. I was just like, can I just reschedule? This is no good.
Did you do it?
Oh yeah, I carried it up.
Oh my God. All right. So you do this live stage show at XOXO.
Yeah. The thing I was most worried about was walking off the front of the stage, honestly. Because it's like
understandable.
Yeah. Like the problem with the chaperone stuff, the guidelines that keep you from walking outside of the playable bounds is that normally they align with a wall. So you don't, you can cheat them a little bit, 'cause there's usually a little bit more room in the edge if you need to. And with this one, if we had cheated in on one of the sides, we would have just walked off into space.
I don't want to talk about this anymore. We have to move on.
Well, and then we had Andre. Andre was there, and we had just built a 2D camera for the first time for this experience. And so we had built a 2D camera so that we could have a third computer backstage that's hooked up to the projector and project the video game world on the screen above us standing on the stage. So it was really cool. So people could see what we were doing on the stage and in the game. And he was, of course, was flying around with drone controls using an Xbox 360 controller or something. But yeah, so after that, we did the Kickstarter because we'd gotten pretty positive reaction to the whole thing. And I guess that maybe the Kickstarter was running while we were doing that. I can't remember the exact timing, but I feel like the Kickstarter and the Quad Cow episode recording were more or less at the same time. Maybe we recorded the Quad Cow episode and then launched the Kickstarter, and the Quad Cow episode was one of the awards. I don't remember the specifics. It's been 5 years, 6 years. But we got bad signal from, we ended up walking away with about 60 grand from Kickstarter, which was like not paying me 5 or 6 months worth of runway. And we assumed that would take about 5 or 6 episodes, would give us about 5 or 6 episodes to make, that we would then be able to sell on Steam to people who hadn't backed the Kickstarter, Steam and the Oculus Store.
Right.
The problem with that was that we had bad signal from the first two games we tried to bring to the Foo Show, because they were a lot easier. We built Foo Show in Unity, we happened to be running the same version of Unity as Firewatch was using, so we didn't have to port anything. Like, there was no, bringing assets in from Firewatch to our thing was really easy. They hadn't written anything with shaders that weren't 3D correct, so all of their shaders would just run in our game. And it was because their kind of art style was relatively low-fi, high style. It ran really well. It ran well enough on the Oculus min-spec hardware to run at a non-barfy frame rate without us having to do a ton of work.
Sure. Can I stop for a second and make note of your use of the phrase bad signal? Like, I've inferred what it meant since you talked about it. Like, it means you got bad intelligence from the early experience you had, right? Like, it means that there were you know, lessons yet to be learned that were lurking underneath the relatively easy time you'd had with those. The reason I bring this up, though, is like, is there a whole handbook of like Silicon Valley, like tech startup VC type terms, like bad signal?
God, I hope not, but there probably is.
Like, there has got to be a giant glossary of, like, you know what I mean? Like, the kinds of like slightly smarmy jargon like that that develops around like work cultures.
I feel attacked.
Look, it's fine if you know what it means.
Well, bad signal is a programming. I always heard it's a programming thing.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean about tech industry startups and stuff.
But. Yeah. It was I think from the time they gave us, a friend of ours came in and helped with the Firewatch episode, Eric Florenzano, and he came in and helped Andre and Sindra and me get that out the door. And I think we did it in like 3 weeks or 4 weeks or something like that. It was really fast. The Quad Cow took a little bit longer, but it was a similar, like, less than a month time frame. We're like, okay, if we can do an episode in a month, that means we can, you know, we raised 60 grand total for us. We can make 5 episodes. No problem. Boy, was I wrong. In the meantime, we were doing a bunch of other stuff. Like, we were doing the other stuff. We started working on the Carl Show and some pilots and other stuff that I can't talk about. And we had so the contract work was lucrative enough that we couldn't say no to it, because it was like, hey, we're going to make a lot of money and it will fund us for a long time without us having to go out and raise money. Now, knowing what I know now, at the moment we had a bunch of business coming in and had a lot of money, I should have gone out and raised like $2 million from VCs, because then we had a working business that we could have raised against.
Sure.
But, you know, the money fountain is never going to dry up. So, you know, what do you do what you can.
Mm-hmm. Best laid plans. Hindsight is 2020, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Let's see. So we got through this whole run. We'd done a couple more episodes of the Foo Show. We did one with Creative Assembly for Warhammer Total War 2, where we went through a bunch of different ways we could do it. And we were like, do we want to be giants walking around on the maps? No, we think that the coolest thing about this is having like huge scale Warhammer characters. So kindly, you all were at E3 and had the suite at whatever hotel you used to do the suites in, the Standard, I think. I can't remember.
Yes. And in the later years, the Standard. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it was not in the skeezy, it used to be a shoe store with a murder room upstairs.
No, place. But the Standard is plenty skeezy.
I mean, different kind of skeezy though. Mm. But yeah, you all let me set up there during the day while you are all out at the show. And we recorded the Total War Warhammer 2 episode in the Giant Bomb suite at the Standard there on the QT.
Oh, how nice of us.
Don't tell anybody. But that one ended up being incredibly difficult because the assets that we used for that were the cinematic assets from their cinematics between levels.
Jeez, seems like I could imagine those are maybe not meant to be kind of procedurally animated in real time.
Well, they were performant. We had to scale them down a little bit, but like it just ended up the animation. I want to say those are Unreal Engine games. I think I can't remember. There was an engine problem in that they used a different kind of animation that we did. So we basically had to re-rig almost everything. And it was a lot. It took a long time. It took like 3 or 4 months. The episode after that, which we did in 2019 or late 2018, was I wanted to do some science episodes that showed like small world, big world stuff. So we did making nanomachines out of DNA with a professor at UCSF.
That's cool.
And that one, Sean Douglas is the professor's name. That one was phenomenal because he'd built an entire lab in VR. Like he'd gotten a grant and hired an artist to recreate all of the tools in his lab in VR because he wanted to train grad students and postdocs how to like work in his VR version of his lab so that he could accelerate time.
That's very cool. I started to say like, oh, this must've been the first one where you had to build all the assets yourself. Right. But like, I did not expect to hear that like college professor was going to show up with an environment ready to go.
Well, so the problem was he hired somebody who was like a film modeler who was used to working not in real time. And so the assets were, nothing was performant. It took us, we had to basically recreate everything. We had to rework everything to make it performant because when we loaded it up the first time, we got like a third of a frame a second on whatever with the beefiest computer we had at the time was.
Yikes.
That we eventually got there. Like it took, but that took 5 months or something ridiculous. So between those two, we already spent more money than we had raised on the Kickstarter, just getting those next two episodes out, damn, which didn't feel good. In the meantime, in order to make up for the pricing of the Kickstarter, which was like $20, so five episodes, four, we wanted to give people one episode free. We were selling like 18 copies on Steam. We did not sell on Steam. At this point, the Foo Show had become kind of a financial stone around our neck,
a money pit.
I mean, I don't know. I'm really proud of the work we did with them. I think they were really good. But yeah, it was costing more money than it was taking, and we did not have money to spare, which felt bad.
I'm actually looking at the Foo Show Steam page as we speak. The Foo Show featuring Will Smith.
Yeah, I'll be honest. Title. I put featuring Will Smith because I thought people would search for Will Smith on Steam, maybe. Also, I was kind of famous briefly in the VR scene.
Oh, right.
The around photo. That time. Yeah. Yeah. Well, not just the photo, but the tested stuff.
Oh, sure.
Like we were really popular in the communities on Reddit and stuff like that.
I just completely forgot about there's this like kind of evening, late night talk show set.
Yeah.
Where you are behind the desk in a suit talking to yourself as the guest in like t-shirt and jeans.
That was one of the VR pitches. That was one of the VC pitches we made. Was me interviewing myself about why we did this. It turns out it's really hard to interview yourself. Who knew?
I can imagine.
Getting the timing right was a bit rough.
I see you're still in early access.
Look, I got bad news for you, Brad. Yeah. Anyway, so we did that. We ran out of money on the Foo Show stuff, but we were spending the money we were making elsewhere to continue making those episodes because we thought it was important. And we had reached the end of like a long run where we were really working hard on like stuff for other people and had some money in the bank. We were like, look, we've identified a bunch of problems with the thing that we've built and some things just to be clear, the productions that we did were ranged from like the Adult Swim thing they did with like a half dozen people in their Atlanta studio on William Street once a week live. And they like literally did a live YouTube video out. So they're doing live animation with the Foo Show out to 2D on YouTube or on their private streaming service, I think. And Matt Harrington at Adult Swim had seen the Foo Show when the Vive was brand new. I think somebody brought a Vive into their offices down there because they made games and stuff at the time too. It was like, hey, you should check this thing out. And he was like, man, we can make cartoons with this. And he called, he literally like went through like some friends that mutual acquaintances and friends and called my cell phone and was like, hey, this is, blah, blah, blah from Adult Swim. Can we talk about the thing that you've made? I was like, sure.
You're
love
like,
you guys. Oh, I'm a big fan.
Let me think about that.
Yeah.
Major television network wants to talk.
Yeah. So, but anyway, then we talked and I came down to Atlanta a couple of times and we like put together some prototypes and he got sign off from the other people at the studio to spend some money on it. And we did a weekly show for 20 weeks, I think. And the other stuff like the GameStop ads we shot in a soundstage in Austin. Like we had 25 people. It was like a regular commercial production.
Wow.
With like script supervisors and audio techs and the whole thing. And Andre and I were running all the tech stuff on that point. Let's see, another one that we did was weird. This was just something we did because I wanted to speak at this conference and couldn't go to Copenhagen that year, but we were invited to speak at a virtual reality conference or a new media conference in Copenhagen. And instead of me flying to Copenhagen, because it was while we were doing another shoot, we just sent them, Sindra took a laptop down there and, plugged it into their projector with our client on it. And then I did it from the garage in San Francisco. That's at incredible. Like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Cause I mean, you can't really be sending that much data, right?
Like hardly anything.
Movement and positional data has to be pretty, pretty damn small.
Look, the voice was way more data than the movements.
Right.
So
yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. So anyway, we've got problems, right? Like there's tech problems here we can fix. Cause all this time Andre had been working in the background on some new stuff to make the animation better, but we hadn't had time to test it and integrate it and all that stuff. And he was like, let's take 3 months. I mean, we all thought it would take 3 months. It's not just Andre, just to be clear. because we had built the entire thing in 3 months, right? So like how hard could it be to fix it, right? It ended up taking a year. Oof. And Sindra and I were still finishing, we were doing Foo Show episodes during that. We had other stuff going, like, but it was mostly, hey, let's integrate. Well, first off, the Index was coming. So we had the ability to do fingers, which was a huge increase in fidelity, like having paddle hands or like programmatically animated fingers versus being able to point is a big deal. We also wanted to do some stuff with better lip sync and face tracking. So he integrated the ability to do around that time, the iPhone depth cameras started being able to do face tracking they use it for emojis, but you could, there's APIs for everybody. And you can do the same thing on Android. So we did some experiments with that stuff and had that working. And we came out of this with like a thing that we could put a voice actor in front of a phone and have them drive the face while a physical motion capture actor is driving the body. Like it's really cool. It works really well. Specifically thinking about production where often it turns out with animated stuff, especially often the voice actors are kind of old and not particularly mobile. So you can put somebody who's young and able and is good at the motion acting part in the bodies and then do the voices and then just map the voices to the faces when the faces on the bodies easily in post-production. So we did that. We came out of that and that we finished that up in like, I don't know, December of 2019.
Fateful.
Yeah.
Fateful pause, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah. Nothing happens between Thanksgiving and like January MLK Day, basically, in content world. Mm-hmm. Often
executives are all taking a lot of time off.
Yeah, it's a big time off time of year for people. Mm-hmm. So we came out of that window into February, and we're like had stuff moving. We had a show that was supposed to run in front of a live studio audience. So like audience sitting in front of a stage with performers on it wearing the tracking gear. And by this point, we'd added foot tracking and hip tracking too. So we had much better fidelity on the legs, which is an early piece of feedback we got.
Wait, what were you tracking those with?
We could do it with a bunch of stuff. We mostly used 5 trackers.
Okay.
But like if you had an IMU suit, you could use that. Like it was the thing that Andre wrote during that, 12 months was basically a hardware agnostic. Let's see, an IK solver that would work regardless of the number of points of data you put on it. So like you could animate a whole body with just a head, which was hilarious. But you could also, if you gave it like 20 points of data or 50 points of data or 100 points of data, it would be increasingly good. It's a lot like what the MetaHuman stuff is. Not MetaHuman. It's what Matt Workman is doing with Unreal these days. Anyway. We were literally about to sign a deal to do the live animated show in front of the live audience when the state of California shut down everybody. Mm-hmm. And then we had 2 other potential projects fall through because we couldn't figure out how to do the recording safely in 2020. That was one of them. The other one, sometimes things just fall through.
Right.
Company still exists. The IP still exists. If anybody wants to buy it, let me know. We're talking.
obviously, like you just said, the pandemic, like logistically made it difficult to impossible to get together and record stuff. Like I assume that also had a dampening effect on people's willingness to throw money at new projects just generally.
I don't think so. It basically meant that the stuff that we were pitching during that time window was much less like 2 or 3 or more people interacting in a space. So one of the big things that we shifted after the first wave, like is that we stopped recording with everybody in the same physical space, because it turns out having the performers being able to teleport around was really important. We were already recording with people in separate spaces by that time. So we could have put them in different rooms and just had them in an area with a network. Right.
Just made me realize how much that tracks with the production process of this podcast.
Yeah.
We were also, we started that in late August 2019, kind of a little past the halfway point.
And God, was it that? Yeah. Wow.
Yes. It has been 3 years. We were trying to get together to record this thing every week for a while until
March of 2020. Weird.
And then it turned out like, it is way more convenient to not have to like plan travel around getting this thing recorded.
Yeah, because it's funny. We don't live particularly far apart, but like if the wrong time of day, it's like a 45-minute drive each way. So we were doing that remotely. We did a couple of things with Cartoon Network and Adult Swim where we had people in Atlanta and people in Burbank like performing together. So like we've been doing that for a long time. It works really well. It's like normal video game latency situation. And Turner had a really fast internet connection, like a straight shot pipe from Burbank to Atlanta. So it was like it was like one hop. It was good latency. It was like speed of light latency there. It's been weird. I think Jeff Grubb this week on something on judging by my Twitter comments. Some Jeff Grubb joked that I invented VTubing, which is absolutely untrue. Although we did talk to like when VTubing was getting popular in China, a bunch of those people reached out because they wanted us to build a VTuber client. And I was like, I don't know that we'll last long enough to make money at the rate at which this in time for this to become a thing.
Right.
I look at what Horizon Facebook's metaverse bullshit thing is, and I feel really good about the level of animation we were doing in 2015, 2016, 2017.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's the big takeaway, I guess.
Compared to what apparently several billion dollars can buy.
I mean, there were 3 of us and some contractors. So, right. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I have a question. It's kind of blunt.
Yeah.
Feel free to defer.
Yeah.
Like, do you feel like the pandemic was the thing that kind of put a bullet into everything? Or like if the pandemic had never happened, like, do you think you'd still be going?
Well, so the weird thing about having a business that you need to sell like one or two things a year to continue going is that it's real easy to get into like a life support territory. I don't know. Like I was pretty tired and burned out by the time we reached the pandemic. And then the pandemic made everything worse. So, had we leaned into the Foo Show early on and had that ready to go on Quest, which we could have been able to do, when the Quest 2 landed, we probably could have done okay if we'd had like 10 or 15 episodes and a subscription thing or something for that.
Is Quest 2 the one, like in terms of market penetration, install base?
My understanding is that install base of Quest 2 is pretty stupid.
Okay.
Pretty good. So that's the other thing that definitely hurt us, is that there was no consumer market for VR for the first like 3 years, unless you were like, if you weren't one of the top three or four VR applications, you were at best breaking even if you ran real. A friend of mine told me in 2016, he was like, look, this market feels like one of those ones that's going to, that the cockroaches are going to survive. And meaning the people who are running the most lean and spending the least money and figuring out how to survive on revenue and stuff like that. And that's the opportunity here, because the people who come out of that cockroach period will be in a good position to excel. And then as we were starting to come out of that cockroach period, the pandemic hit, which was bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, would I do it again?
Well,
I don't know.
You're just sitting here asking my questions for me at this point.
Yeah, I spent a lot of my own money doing this. Don't spend your own money doing your own startups if you can help it. That's my advice.
That is rough. Is there any upkeep around the company continuing to exist?
Yes.
Like, is there?
It's not like, much.
Okay.
It's like you got to file a tax return.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, is it essentially easier to just keep doing that than go through whatever rigmarole there is to shut it down?
Well, once I go through the rigmarole to shut it down, the chance of recovering any money out of it goes away.
Aha. Okay.
So, yeah.
Oh, I see. There's always a chance.
There's always a chance. People reach out every few months. Like, oh. I get emails from people. So okay. We will see. I it probably will not be around indefinitely. Yeah.
Well, thank you for this candid look behind the scenes.
Yeah, starting companies. I'm going to go and tell you, when Trump got elected and was like, I'm going to repeal Obamacare, I suddenly started getting really nervous. Like that the stress of that added, multiplied dramatically what is already a stressful thing.
Yes.
And I my question to anyone who says that socialized medicine is going to hurt innovation, I think that those people, what they really mean is they're going to make it harder for talented companies to retain talented employees who might want to go do something on their own. Because right now, healthcare is a shackle in the United States.
It's a nightmare.
There's a reason most of our guests on the FOSPOD are from Europe, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I fully agree with you on that.
Yeah. And that was the biggest thing. Yeah. The other thing I will say is that the amount of bullshit that you have to understand about how incorporation and legal stuff and paying tax, like, everything is so much more infinitely complicated than it needs to be.
You have no idea.
I know
people listening who have never had to deal with this stuff. Like, you have no idea.
Yeah. That like if people are serious about encouraging small businesses, ask your politicians what you can do to make starting a small business easier, because it is frighteningly complicated. Now, the good thing is, and somebody, a friend of the pod told me this, when we were about 2 years in, and I was like, I'm really worried I'm going to go to jail or something. He laughed. He's like, oh, look, all of the problems that you're going to have are pay fine problems, not go to jail problems. So, you know, if that helps. And I was like, okay, that was when the bank account was good. So that did actually help. When the bank account was bad, pay fine problems were maybe scarier than go to jail problems. I don't know. Anyway, I said the one thing I would like, do stuff with co-founders.
Yeah.
If you're going to start something, have two people.
Yes.
It's nice to be able to split that load.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's lonely at the top.
It's only when it's only one person, you only have yourself to blame. So, but yeah. Yeah. fucking health insurance, man.
Yes.
Health insurance kills you. Yeah. I was spending as much money on health insurance at one point during that whole thing as I was on the house loan almost.
Good God, man.
And that's in the Bay Area. So three people. It's ridiculous.
Some might say it's unsustainable.
Yeah, well, not the health insurance companies, that's for sure.
No.
They love it.
All right, this is getting depressing.
Yeah, okay. Brad, I guess this is the time when we thank our patrons.
Yeah, thank you, patrons.
Thanks, patrons. I hope people enjoyed this episode. I it feels oddly kind of cathartic to talk about, actually.
I can see that for you and educational for me, and I hope a lot of people listening.
Yeah, I hope people don't feel like it's self-indulgent.
No, I don't think so. It's instructive.
Yeah, there you go. A cautionary tale.
I mean, we could probably do a whole series about like talking to people, trying to get investment and paying how to handle employees, contractors versus and full time. And
look,
there's probably a zillion ins and outs of this topic that would be interesting to discuss.
I don't know if Gusto started while I was doing this or if I just found out about them late. But when somebody was like, hey, do you know about Gusto? I went and looked at what it was and I was like, it does payroll and all of the associated taxes and stuff for you. I was like, oh, thank Christ. Because even like QuickBooks and the stuff that also does payroll, it's still a huge pain in the ass. And Gusto handles all the reporting and stuff for you. Still have, like with QuickBooks, you still have to print out stuff and send it in every quarter, six weeks or something. And Gusto is really nice.
So. Yeah, it's kind of crazy how many like little turnkey services there are now that facilitate small business stuff. You know, like you can hire part-time CFOs now.
Yes. I mean, it used to be you had to know a CFO who's willing to work part-time to do that. Now you can just get somebody. Yeah,
right.
It's really good. Anyway, that's it. That's us.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah. Hello. Thank you. Thank you for the walk down memory lane. And thank you to our patrons for supporting us.
Yes. Thank you, patrons. If you would like to find out how to become a patron of Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod, you can go to patreon.com/techpod. That's patreon.com/techpod. And for $2 a month or more, if you want, I mean, we'll take more. You can help support our show. We appreciate you all.
Yes.
But we especially appreciate our executive producer tier patrons, including Paddle Creek Games, makers of Fractured Veil, Andrew Slosky, Octothorpe. I feel like there's a share thing happening here.
Uh-oh.
Wedge, assistant to the Thread Club manager.
Whoa.
Joel Krauska, Twinkie at Hacker Summer Camp, and James Kamek. Thank you all so much. We appreciate you.
Yes.
I guess that's it for us this week.
You look a little frazzled.
This is a lot, man.
Sure it was. Thank you for taking the time.
I feel like I'm the guest this week. That's weird.
Ooh, look.
I hadn't thought about it that much, it turns out. Anyway, see y'all next week. Bye, everybody.